Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Friends, I again implore you to comply with social distancing and stay at home unless your work is considered essential. It's up to us to save the most vulnerable during the COVID-19 crisis. In the late 1980s, Biloxi, Mississippi was teeming with corruption, run unofficially by the Dixie Mafia. It wasn't exactly a secret. By 1983, the FBI was investigating Biloxi and Harrison County, where it's located. Vincent and Margaret Sherry were pillars of Biloxi. One local commented that if you just said Vince and Margaret, everyone knew who you meant. Vince, a conservative Democrat, was a circuit court judge and a criminal defense attorney. Some of his former clients were in the Dixie Mafia. His wife, Margaret, an old-school Republican, was a former city councilwoman with ambitions to be mayor. She wanted to clean up crime and corruption in Biloxi. They might have seemed like an odd couple. Vince had defended the very criminals Margaret wanted put away. But they were like bookends, perfectly complementing each other. Both were natural-born politicians, gregarious and well-respected in their community. When they were murdered in their home in September of 1987, it immediately looked like a professional hit. This was no burglary. But who was the real target? The judge with former connections to the Dixie Mafia? Or his wife, determined to become mayor and expose the corruption in Biloxi, as well as shut down illegal brothels and gambling run by the Dixie Mafia? It would take years to unravel the conspiracy and the steely determination of their oldest daughter to see it through. Welcome to episode 91, The Sherry Murders, Dixie Mafia and Corruption in Biloxi. Sitting on the Gulf of Mexico, Biloxi, Mississippi today is well known for its beaches and casinos. But legal gambling didn't come to Mississippi until the 1990s. First settled by the French in 1699, it went from French rule to British rule in 1763. To Spanish rule from 1779 to 1810. Then in 1811, Biloxi came under control of the United States of America as part of the Mississippi Territory. Mississippi was admitted to the Union in 1817. Despite this, Biloxi remained largely French in character. It became a summer resort, with the advantages of close proximity to New Orleans and ease of travel by water. The beachfront of Biloxi lies directly on the Mississippi Sound, with barrier islands scattered off the coast and into the Gulf of Mexico. Rich farmers and businessmen built summer homes there, and soon hotels and rental cottages started dotting the beaches. Biloxi's casino history dates back to a period in the 1940s. When open, if technically illegal, gambling took place in a casino within the Broadwater Beach Resort. Open gambling ended in the 1950s. It became known as the Poor Man's Riviera for the tourist industry. But otherwise, commercially, Biloxi was dominated by the shrimp and oyster industry. In the early 1960s, the Gulf Coast became a new southern vacation destination for northerners as an alternative to Florida, with Biloxi at the center. Hotels hired French chefs and upgraded their amenities and offered some of the best seafood in the country. In the late 60s and early 70s, the Dixie Mafia began and Biloxi was soon their home base. The FBI defines the Dixie Mafia as, quote, a loose confederation of thugs and crooks who conducted their criminal activity in the southeastern United States. One word got out that Biloxi, with its history of strip clubs and illicit gambling, was a safe haven. The criminals settled in. The Poor Man's Riviera had become a seedy strip of nightclubs and motels, which also served as strip clubs and gambling dens. Mike Gillich Jr. was known as the godfather of Biloxi. He owned many of the motels and clubs. His strip clubs often had brothels running in the back rooms, and he ran a tight ship. Known as Mr. Mike, he was the most well-known and trusted member of the Dixie Mafia. There wasn't much structure to their organization, of everything from petty crimes to armed robbery and murders. But they had one motto, "Thou shalt not snitch to the cops." Also known as the Cornbread Cosa Nostra, the Dixie Mafia ran prostitution and pornography rings. They were drug smugglers and distributors, and of course, contract killers. In 1983, the FBI started investigating Biloxi and Harrison County. They found that the entire Harrison County Sheriff's Office was a criminal enterprise. Special Agent Keith Bell said, quote, "They were doing anything and everything illegal down there. For money, Sheriff Hobbs and officers loyal to him would release prisoners from the county jail, safeguard drug shipments, and hide fugitives. Anything you can think of, they were involved in." There were a few non-corrupt police officers, and they helped the FBI end the corruption. In 1984, Sheriff Leroy Hobbs was convicted of racketeering and was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Vincent and Margaret Sherry had settled in Biloxi in 1971 after traveling the world. Vince had enlisted in the Air Force in 1951, where he spent 7 years as an intelligence officer and served as a judge advocate for 13 years. He retired at the rank of colonel. Born in February 1929 in Kings, New York, Vincent Sherry grew up in Paducah, Kentucky. He attended Western Kentucky University, where he received a Bachelor of Arts degree, Middle Tennessee State University, where he received a Master of Arts degree, the University of Southern Mississippi, where he received a PhD, and George Washington University, where he received a Bachelor of Laws degree. He had earned what they used to call a Juris Doctor. Vince was licensed to practice law in Virginia, Kentucky, and Mississippi. He was also able to practice in the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals, the U.S. Tax Court, and the Court of Military Appeals. He also taught at the University of Southern Mississippi for 8 years. He taught upper division and graduate political science and criminal justice classes. If it isn't already apparent, Vincent Sherry was a brilliant man. He spoke 5 languages and did his doctoral thesis on the judicial system of South Vietnam. He was like a walking encyclopedia, and he loved using obscure words to keep his family on their toes. His daughter Lynn said that her father fervently believed ignorance, not evil, to be humanity's worst sin. In 1981, he began a criminal law practice in Biloxi with his partner, Pete Hallett. They defended many Dixie Mafia members, including the godfather, Mr. Mike. And Hallett's big client was another big gun named Kirksey Nix. In prison for life, Nix ran all illegal activity inside the prison and a lot on the outside. Pete Hallett defended him from 1979 to 1988. By July of 1986, when Vince was appointed as a circuit court judge, he and Pete Hallett had built a lucrative practice. His skills as a defense attorney really helped him as a judge. He was considered very fair, not partial to either side, and so kind to defendants that they actually sent him thank you cards and Christmas cards after he sent them to prison. Pete Hallett later said it was because he talked to defendants, explaining carefully why he was sending them to prison. But Vince Sherry wasn't without his faults. He had a mercurial temper that wasn't helped by his high blood pressure and frequent headaches. He and Margaret could fight viciously, and he had very high standards for his children and could often seem distant. He also had a sharp sense of humor, almost biting at times, with a gift for choosing spot-on nicknames for people, whether they liked it or not. But his family still adored and revered him. He was well-known and beloved in the community as a very generous man, kind to strangers, and a friend to all. And though he wasn't necessarily handsome in a classic sense, he was magnetic, much to his wife's annoyance, as many women were drawn to him. Margaret Joyce Smith was born in July of 1929 in Mooringsport, Louisiana, but grew up in Kentucky, in Bowling Green. She attended Western Kentucky University and was a schoolteacher for a while. She and Vince met at Western, and they married in 1950, both at age 21, before Vince joined the Air Force. Margaret was a force to be reckoned with as well. She was a Biloxi City Councilwoman from 1981 to 1985, and she ran for mayor as a Republican in 1985, but lost to incumbent mayor Gerald Blessy, who was her sworn nemesis. She outwardly hated him and made no bones about it. Margaret was an old-style Republican, and Blessy was a liberal Democrat and a decorated Vietnam War veteran. He described himself as a reformer, and he was popular in Biloxi's poor black community. Biloxi's economy at the time was in the shitter. The fancy old hotels on the waterfront were practically bankrupt due to a huge slump in tourism. Mayor Gerald Blessy had a plan for a new waterfront with a new 200-room hotel and a French-style marketplace. Naturally, the old hotel owners opposed this, knowing they would definitely be thrown out of business. And well-to-do Biloxians off West Beach and North would rather see municipal funds used to pave streets and fill potholes. But Blessy's plan proposed 1,400 new jobs, while promising to preserve the history and culture of Biloxi. It was definitely a city divided, with a margin of only 500 votes letting Blessy keep his job. But Margaret wasn't going anywhere. She planned to run again for mayor in 1989. In the meantime, she showed up to every city council meeting to oppose Mayor Blessy and his policies. And she used the voter referendum process to accomplish blocking his proposals and goals. She often accused him of associating with crime and vice leaders of the underworld in backroom deals. She accused him of misspending government funds, something the FBI did look into, because Biloxi officials had released $160,000 of HUD grant funds to start development costs without federal approval. The mayor and company basically claimed that they had verbal authorization, and they just didn't have it in writing. Despite this, and an IRS audit, Blessy mostly came out clean. But many people believed that after Vince had been appointed to the bench, Margaret had a damn good chance of winning in 1989. Gerald Blessy, in turn, also made no secret of his hate for Margaret Sherry. He called her a racist and pointed out to the press that her husband was the one who profited from crime as a criminal defense attorney. It was ugly, and it was very public. When the Sherrys were found murdered, their granddaughter Kathy was devastated. She was especially close to her grandmother and had even helped with her first mayoral campaign. She talked on the phone to Margaret all the time about Biloxi corruptions and scandals. When her mother, Lynn, broke the news to her, Kathy remarked, "Where the hell was Gerald Blessy?" I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. On Monday, September 14th, 1987, Vince and Margaret had a fairly normal day. Vince went to court that morning for his normal docket, and then got a haircut, and then he filled up his car with gas because he and Margaret were going to Baton Rouge the next day to visit their youngest daughter, Leslie, at college. He chatted for a while with his law partner, Pete Hallett, before he got home and went for a jog. Margaret did some work herself. She was constantly telling friends and family that she was about to expose major corruption in City Hall. She did some work on her upcoming mayoral campaign, and then she went shopping for a few new dresses and electric calculators for her office. She spoke to three different friends later that day about how she was working with the FBI and planned to help put Mayor Gerald Blessy in jail. One of her friends warned her she shouldn't talk like that without proof. Margaret answered, "Don't you understand? I have the goods. I have documentation." She told her friends she intended to make her claims public at the city council meeting the next day, when the city's new budget was set to be adopted. According to author Edward Humes in his book, Mississippi Mud, her last call was cut off abruptly. The friend had heard Vince in the background, complaining about being hungry and wanting to go to dinner, so she assumed Margaret just hung up to deal with him. The next day, no one missed them. Everyone knew they were supposed to be in Baton Rouge. Leslie didn't raise the alarm, so maybe she thought they had changed their minds. One of their dogs was scheduled to have a cataract removed, so maybe that had delayed them. By Wednesday morning, though, Vince was due in court. The court staff called his law partner, Pete Hallett, a little before 9 a.m. when Vince hadn't shown up. Pete tried to call the Sherry house, but he didn't get an answer. At 11 a.m., he went over to the house with his law firm associate, Charles Leager. He stepped in the house briefly and then shouted for the neighbor to call the police. He told Charles Leager that Vince and Margaret were both dead. Police went in the house and found the Sherry's dachshund, Mo, barking and growling next to Vince's body, protecting him. When they walked to the bedroom, Mo raced in there and stood over Margaret barking and baring his fangs. Later, this detail was hard for police and the Sherry kids. Vince and Margaret had two dachshunds, Mo and Fritz, who they doted on. They called them the boys. Lynn and her siblings felt like the boys never would have let a stranger in the house without barking or biting them even. They ferociously protected their masters. They thought it had to be someone the Sherrys knew. They pointed out to the cops that the dogs had not attacked Pete Hallett. Later, investigators would come to believe that Vince opened the door to the killer, who put a gun in his face. So he shooed the dogs into his bedroom where Margaret was and quickly shut the door. Margaret probably just thought someone was at the door Vince needed to talk to, so he got the dogs out of the way. There's no indication she was alarmed. And then Vince came back to face the man, who shot him from 2 feet away, sending him flailing backwards, spraying blood on the walls and ceiling. He was shot in the mouth, shattering his teeth. Margaret had been undressing for the evening. She was clad only in her bra and underwear, and she had one earring in her hand, as if she had been removing her jewelry. There was no blood spray. She was shot 4 times point blank in the head, and just one stream of blood flowed from her temple onto her body. She was slumped against the bed with her feet under the dresser, like she had just slid down. There were 2 bullets in the wall, so if she heard those, she may have had a moment to turn and see her killer, but she may not have heard them at all. Police found rubber foam around their wounds and the floor around their bodies. It looked as though someone had shot through a pillow or used a homemade silencer. Which made sense, as Margaret was clearly caught off guard. She hadn't heard the shots her husband had suffered, and probably not the 2 that went in the wall near where she was standing. With 1 bullet left in the gun, the assassin went back to where Vince lay. From the amount of blood around his body, detectives believed he had been alive when the killer went for Margaret. The killer then shot Vince in the face again, hitting just below his right eye, finishing him off. The dogs had not been harmed as the killer fled, and they had been in the house for a day, guarding their dead masters. Multiple departments helped search the crime scene. The FBI, Mississippi Highway Patrol, Harrison County Sheriff's Department, and the Biloxi Police Department. But it was the Biloxi police who took the lead on the investigation. Pete Hallett's official story to police and the Sherry kids was that he looked in through the sliding glass door and saw the dogs, and he also saw that there was dog excrement on the rug. He said that alarmed him, so he tried the handle and it opened. He said he walked in far enough to see Vince's body before coming outside and telling a neighbor to call the police. when Lynn Sposito, the oldest Sherry daughter, pressed Pete, insisting her imagination was worse than not knowing. He just said he only saw her father, that he had clearly been shot, and he had not gone in because he didn't want to see her mom. The oldest Sherry child, Eric Sherry, had called Lynn from his home in Florida. One of his Biloxi friends had called to offer condolences after he heard the news on the radio. This makes me crazy. Biloxi police, if not Pete Hallett, should have immediately made calls to the Sherry kids so they didn't find out this way. Eric said he would call the youngest, Leslie, if Lynn would call Vin. Vincent Sherry III had the worst temper, and they definitely did not want him finding out from the news. When Lynn hung up with him, he was already planning on buying a gun. Lynn then had the horrific responsibility of not only telling her brother, but calling other family members to spread the word. After one aunt dropped the receiver screaming, Lynn hung up and couldn't do it anymore. She was waiting for her husband to get home. Dick Sposito was her rock, but he traveled a lot, so she hadn't even been able to get on the phone with him right away. When he called back and she told him, he immediately said he would get home as soon as possible. But he was in Paris and couldn't get a flight until the next day. So Lynn had a full day to wait for the comfort of her husband's arms. And she still had to tell her children, who adored their grandparents. Lynn and her family lived in North Carolina, and so did her brother Vin. Eric was in Florida, and Leslie was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The message they gave each other was, get home, now, as fast as you can. Lynn went and picked up her 16-year-old daughter Kathy first, who immediately made the remark about Margaret's nemesis, Mayor Gerald Blessy. A neighbor who had come to sit with Lynn offered to go pick up her youngest, 7-year-old Beth, at the bus stop and keep her at her house for a while until Lynn could tell the older kids and make more phone calls. After picking up Kathy and breaking the news, Lynn picked up her 13-year-old son Tommy from junior high and told him as well. And then she waited for her siblings. Leslie and Eric were driving into Biloxi, while Lynn caught the next flight to Biloxi with her kids. Vin was waiting to fly in the next day so he could bring his wife. Once they were all together, they headed straight to the Hallett and Sherry Law Office to meet with Pete Hallett. He had told them to come to see him first, and they trusted him. He had told Eric he would use his contacts to find out as much as he could. Lynn left her 2 youngest children with a friend, but 16-year-old Kathy insisted on coming too. Pete Hallett greeted them warmly, hugging Lynn. He promised he would help them in any way he could. But just as Eric was about to ask the first question, Pete cut him off. He said, quote, listen, there's something you need to understand. There is nothing you can do to bring your parents back to life. Nothing. The best thing you can do is drop it. Shocked, Eric and Lynn asked, was it Blessy? Is that why you want us to drop it? But Pete Hallett would not elaborate. As they were leaving, Kathy Sposito, Margaret's fiery granddaughter, said, I don't trust him. Lynn tried to give Pete the benefit of the doubt. He was her father's best friend, and though he was well known and loved in Biloxi, Vince didn't have many close friends. A joint funeral for the Sherrys was held on September 19, 1987, at Nativity Cathedral. Pete Hallett gave the eulogy. He reportedly said he was so close to the couple that he considered them family. The Clarion Ledger described the stories Hallett told in his eulogy as giving attendees both pause and levity. Why has God deemed to take Vincent and Margaret away from us and allow a wild animal to remain among us? He intoned from the podium. Hallett later passed out copies of his eulogy to members of the media. He had his own political ambitions and didn't waste this moment for publicity, despite how tasteless it was. Pete Hallett had been dismissed almost immediately as a suspect. Even though he was the last to see Vince and the person to find the bodies, they found his story credible. After some digging, they found that Vince had been turned down on a life insurance policy for the law practice due to his high blood pressure. So Pete didn't have a financial motive. And besides, Vince was his best friend. As the investigation continued, some people told the police that Vince had received threats since he had started practicing law in Biloxi. But Pete Hallett said, Vince never told him about any threats. He said, if there had been threats, I am positive he would have told me. But starting in 1981, the Sherry couple received letters from someone named Bryce Hundeman, who opposed some of the couple's political opinions. In 1986, Vince put an ad in the paper that said in all caps, "Invitation to Bryce Hundeman. As you probably know, I have been appointed to the circuit judge's bench to replace Judge Griffin. In view of your long interest in my professional activities, I certainly hope to see you at my installation reception." When townspeople were getting frustrated that the murders weren't solved within a few days, the Biloxi Public Safety Director said, "It will take time. It was a professional job. It'll be very difficult for us to solve." Only a few days after the murders, Gulf Coast businessmen put their money together to make a $50,000 reward for information. That would be around $111,000 today. The Sherrys lived across the street from a golf course. In hopes of finding evidence, the police searched the golf course and a pond on the course, but found nothing. The police immediately said that Mayor Gerald Blessy had been out of town during the murders and also the next night, uncharacteristically missing a council meeting. As far as they were concerned, Blessy was dropped as a suspect. The Sherry kids were angry about this. Blessy was the prime suspect in their minds. Not that he murdered their parents himself, but that he had set it up. And now it was his police station and his detectives investigating the murders. From the start, police believed the murders were the work of a professional because there was nothing missing from the house. There was no sign of forced entry. Police wondered if maybe a criminal Judge Sherry had sentenced was getting revenge on the judge. But after talking to Lynn, they found out that Vince's black appointment book was missing. They held this back in the media, hoping to find a suspect, even though common sense would tell you the killer probably already disposed of it. Police took Vince's files from his time as a defense attorney and also from when he was a judge. They wanted to look through them to see if they could find anyone who had motive to kill the Sherrys. A neighbor came nervously to Lynn because he had seen a car the night the Sherrys were murdered. He was nervous because it looked like an unmarked police car. The yellow car was found 2 days later. It had been stolen and the tags replaced, but Biloxi police immediately dismissed it as pertinent to the case, again angering Lynn. She felt it was a good lead. In March of 1988, a new task force took over and reviewed everything the previous task force had done to see if they had missed anything. In September of 1988, it was announced by Biloxi's public safety director that the Sherry's son, Eric, was a suspect in the murders. He said that Eric's friends told them he would be in Biloxi that weekend before his parents were murdered. He also said that Eric, quote, did not register sufficient emotion after his parents were killed, and he refused to take a lie detector test. Many people handle grief differently, some growing numb, especially when among strangers. Also, it had already been proven that Eric was in Florida when his parents were murdered. This was all bullshit and a cruel reason to go after Eric. Eric said that he and other families did refuse to take a polygraph the week of the murders, but he went back later to take one and was told by the Harrison County Sheriff that it wouldn't be necessary. This is because, while questioning Lynn, they told her they suspected one of her siblings because they found out he was adopted. It was a huge family secret. Eric was actually Vince's nephew. He and Margaret took him in when he was a baby. He had never guessed why he looked so different from his siblings. His father had been of Asian descent, and while Eric didn't look Asian, he did have very dark hair and was dark-complected, unlike the rest of his family. Lynn begged the police not to tell him. She and all the siblings would comply to polygraphs if they promised not to tell Eric. She didn't want him to find out this way. Lynn also claimed that she had initially agreed to the polygraph, but only if other Biloxi officials were tested. The police denied she said that to them. Lynn had to tell her brother he was adopted, and that's why the police were looking at him so hard. He said it was one of the worst moments of his life, like when he heard his parents were dead. He felt alone and empty. Later in that September of 1988, police held a press conference to give an update. They said they had, quote, no concrete motive, no concrete suspects, and no plan to drop the investigation. In response, Lynn told the press, quote, a year without results is long enough. You don't know whether it's genuine ignorance or a very sloppy cover-up. By mid-1989, there were rumors that Vince had been involved in a money scam involving Angola prison inmates. There were also rumors that Pete Hallett met with two inmates to plan the Sherry murders. Of course, Pete Hallett said he wasn't involved. He said, quote, let me once again state that any suggestion I was involved in the planning of the murder of Vincent and Margaret Sherry is an outright lie. The local police investigated the murders for 2 years, but didn't get anywhere. So the FBI came back in 1989. And Special Agent Keith Bell started investigating the murders alongside the new Biloxi police captain, Randy Cook. They found 345 phone calls between Pete Hallett's office and the Angola prison in Louisiana. The calls ranged from December 1986 until September 15th, 1987, the day after the Sherrys were murdered. When they asked Pete Hallett who the calls were with, he said they were between a law office aide and his client, Kirksey Nix. Kirksey Nix was a former leader in the Dixie Mafia, now imprisoned for life in Angola for murdering a grocer in New Orleans in 1972. But in Angola, business hadn't stopped for Kirksey Nix. The team then found prison records that showed Hallett had been meeting with Nix in prison around the same time the phone calls began. Also, in 1989, Lynn hired private investigator Rex Armistead to investigate her parents' murders. She couldn't have chosen better. Armistead had been investigating the Dixie Mafia since 1976. I'm going to pause here for a word from our sponsors. I think we are all feeling a little stressed these days, and while it's nice to have a close friend or partner to confide in, sometimes you need an objective professional. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. Finding a therapist in your area is not easy. Finding one quickly is even harder. Why not connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online space? BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating anxiety, stress, depression, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. If you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time with no additional charges, and everything you share is confidential. And there is even financial aid for those who qualify. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. And Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code Southern. Why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/Southern. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/Southern. Kirksey Nix Jr. was a strange character. He had tested with an IQ of 180, and he was the son of a criminal appeals court judge, Kirksey Nix Sr., and his mother had also been an attorney. He didn't grow up poor or neglected, and he didn't grow up in a life of crime. He chose it. When Rex Armistead came on board as the family's private investigator, he developed an immediate rapport with the FBI agent on the case, Keith Bell, and the new police captain, Randy Cook. These men had also gained the trust of Lynn Sposito, not an easy thing to do after all she had been through. Throughout the investigations and later trials, she was constantly frustrated that she seemed to know more about the case than officials or the prosecutors. Bell and Cook told Rex Armistead that Kirksey Nix was in charge of a cash scam from inside prison. At the direction of Nix, the scammers paid off guards in order to use the prison telephones. They would place ads in gay publications like The Advocate, saying they were looking for love or just some summer fun and asking for a phone number. Men would reply to the P.O. box provided in the ad. Then the scammers would start one of their many ploys to get money out of the gay men. In all the ploys, the scammers would send racy photographs to keep the gay men interested. Of course, the photos weren't of themselves. They were usually beefcake pinups. Kirksey Nix said he used the name Eddie Johnson and would send a fake photo showing himself as buff and young. He also had a gift of changing his voice to sound younger and even like a woman sometimes as the scams moved on to straight men. The scammers would usually say something like they were in jail on false charges and just needed a little money to get out. And once they were out, they would be free to come to their benefactors, either for a relationship or just for a hookup. And if that didn't work, they would blackmail closeted gay men by threatening to out them. Dozens of men wired money to Nix through Western Union. One man took a second mortgage out on his house and sent Nix $100,000. That's about $230,000 today. Another man sent around $20,000, which is about $40,000 today. And since so many of the men were closeted, once they realized they were being scammed, they were hesitant to press charges for fear of losing their jobs and other social ruin. But some did report the scams, only to be laughed off by homophobic and corrupt police. The scam lasted from 1986 to 1989. If you're wondering what a man who was spending life in prison needed that money for, well, it was to bribe his way out of prison. He planned to pay for a pardon, either from the parole board or from then-Governor Edwin Edwards. It wasn't much of a stretch with the corruption in local and state government. In 2001, former Governor Edwards was convicted of racketeering and sentenced to 10 years in prison. And though he was a popular governor, in his time in office from 1972 to 1996, he was plagued with accusations of corruption. After finding out about the Lonely Hearts scam, Rex Armistead went to Angola Prison and met with Dixie Mafia member Bobby Joe Fabian. He knew him well after investigating the Dixie Mafia for so long. Bobby Joe was also a lifer, serving time for murder and kidnapping, and he sang like a canary to Rex Armistead. He revealed that Kirksey Nix had planted a full-time associate at the Hallett and Sherry law firm to help run the scam. She was his girlfriend, Sherry LaRaw Sharp. She went by LaRaw, a nickname. Sherry Sharp had been born in an Arkansas brothel. Her mother was a madam, and she was exploited, turned out hooking for her mother by the time she was a teen. Her nickname had been Punkin for a long time, and that's what Kirksey called her. She claimed to have fallen in love with him at the age of 10 when he visited her mother's bordello. But she preferred the nickname LaRaw and went by that, though Kirksey would often make fun of her behind her back, calling her Lala. She would go to the P.O. boxes for Nix, collect the scam cash, and deposit it into the law firm's trust account. But in December of 1986, Nix found out that $100,000 was missing from the account, though some sources put that figure around $200,000. He called Pete Hallett for a face-to-face meeting at Angola. When Nix confronted Hallett about the missing money, he blamed it on his law partner, Vincent Sherry. Mike Gillich, known as Mr. Mike, the godfather of Biloxi, was not in jail and also called for a meeting with Pete. He also profited from the Lonely Hearts scam and wanted answers. Pete Hallett again blamed his supposed best friend and partner, Vince Sherry. Bobby Joe Fabian, said later in a TV interview in which he hid his face, quote, Hallett knew that somebody was going to die, and better Sherry than him. Bobby Joe estimated that the scam had brought in around $5 million, though again, other sources say it was closer to a few hundred thousand dollars. Still, no small scheme. Bobby Joe knew all of this because he had once been part of the scam. He signed his last name in the female way, B-O-B-B-I-E-J-O. Ironically, like the victim in my last episode. He also was adept at changing his voice on the phone. But he had stopped participating because he thought Kirk Zenix was taking too many risks. His ego had gotten ahead of him. He thought he was untouchable. He had Mr. Mike on the outside, the support of not only Lara, but of course, a legit law firm, helping to launder the money. And Kirksey actually had a wife, a woman named Kelly Newsom Nix. She had been the daughter of another girlfriend of his, who he had actually adopted as his stepdaughter. When she came of age and he tired of her mother, he got involved with Kelly. When she was 22, Kirksey announced he was in love with her and wanted to marry her. She was reluctant, but Kirksey promised her that Pete Hallett, his attorney, would help with her legal issues. And he did. In 1983, she and Kirksey were married over the phone. It was done in front of a lone judge with phony licenses, with Pete Hallett as the only witness. Kelly wouldn't find out until later that Hallett had never filed the marriage certificate. He did so in March of 1987, at Nix's request, around the time he found out about his missing money. A wife could not be compelled to testify against her husband. And Kelly did have a lot of drug and alcohol problems. She was arrested for a DUI, and they found cocaine on her. And Pete Hallett always bailed her out. And she also worked some at the law firm, though she was mainly an outside runner for Kirksey. In 1986, Pete had Kelly call Kirksey with a warning. He had told her, quote, you'd better tell Kirksey he better leave those fags alone. The FBI was already looking into the scam. Over the years, as Kelly struggled with her addictions, Nix would go back to Lara. Then she would get back in his good graces and show up at a beach house he owned, only to find Lara living there. It was a constant source of drama. Bobby Joe said that Lara often visited Nix in prison and got busted bringing him marijuana. That's when Bobby Joe dropped out of the scam. All the while, Pete Hallett was signing legal affidavits claiming that Sherry Lara Sharp was a paralegal with his firm. No one knows what really happened to the money. Obviously, the family of Vincent Sherry were offended at the implication that their father had taken the money. The obvious suspect is Pete Hallett. He was already a liar and a cheat. Vince just didn't know it. But whatever Hallett did with the money, he hid it well. Bobby Joe also told Rex Armistead that Kirksey and Mr. Mike had hired a legendary assassin in the Dixie Mafia named John Ransom. He was a one-legged man who worked quietly out of Georgia. He had been arrested numerous times since the 70s for burglary, assault, rape, and bootlegging. He was suspected in many murders, usually men or women set to testify against someone in the Dixie Mafia. In 1989, as was suspected, Pete Hallett ran for mayor of Biloxi, and he won. He basically ran on Margaret Sherry's back. He was the first Republican elected in Biloxi since Reconstruction after the Civil War. As Hallett continued to battle allegations, public and private, the DA's office was grappling with whether or not to take the conspiracy case to trial. Agent Bell and Captain Cook, and obviously Lynn, were pressuring them hard to try it. So they took it to a grand jury after weeks of studying the Luminous files and deciding on the right charges for indictment. At this point, it was a bitter pill to swallow, but Lynn believed the accounts of people who had agreed to speak to investigators. Gerald Blessy, her mother's nemesis, was not involved. However, a federal grand jury indicted Blessy and associates for fraud, conspiracy, and extortion. And it was the investigation that Margaret Sherry was involved with that brought it all out. He went to trial, but it ended in a mistrial when the jury failed to reach a verdict. In 1992, a judge from the second judicial jurisdiction of Harrison County dismissed the charges. Ironically, the same bench that Vincent Sherry had sat on. Gerald Blessy was nominated as city attorney in 2016 by then-mayor Andrew Gillich, no relation apparently to Mr. Mike Gillich. Mississippi takes care of its own. Blessy eventually resigned the position later in the year, stating that at age 74, he was ready to retire. In 1987, investigators had gotten a real break in the case. Charles Leager came forward. He was the law firm associate with Pete Hallett the day of the murders, and later testified that Hallett said Vince and Margaret were both dead, though Pete had always claimed he didn't go into the house far enough to see Margaret. Hallett tried to explain this away, that he just assumed Margaret was dead. But Charles had been hired to take up the slack after Vince was nominated to the bench. He knew things. And he knew he had seen John Ransom before. Seeing his face on TV proved it. He had met up with Pete Hallett. By 1990, Kelly Nix had come around. She had cleaned up her life, had a daughter, and wanted to do the right thing. She would make an excellent witness at trial, no matter how much Nix and his associates tried to intimidate her. John Ransom seemed to be another good witness. By then, he was a sick old man in a Mississippi prison, missing his family. He swore he hadn't killed the Sherrys, but had knowledge of the murders and would give detail with immunity. He told investigators that he had refused to kill a woman, so he passed it off to another hitman. But he did provide the murder weapon with a homemade silencer. But when the DA was ready to move on indictments, Ransom had been moved to a Georgia prison, closer to his family, and he refused to cooperate any longer. The prosecution was hesitant to take it to trial, but they took it before a grand jury anyway. The indictments they asked for were for the intricate Lonely Hearts scam, murder conspiracy, wire fraud, and two counts of traveling in interstate commerce for murder to hire. To everyone's surprise, the grand jury agreed. And in May 1991, Kirksey Nix, Mr. Mike Gillich, John Ransom, and Sherry LaRoche Sharp were all indicted on 15 collective counts. Pete Hallett was often mentioned in the press as an unindicted co-conspirator, much to his expressive anger. He loved shouting to the press about this persecution of his character. Nix, Gillich, Sharp, and Ransom were indicted with conspiracy murder and wire fraud. Nix, Gillich, and Ransom were indicted for murder for hire, including aiding and abetting by traveling from Louisiana to Mississippi to arrange the murder, and murder for hire for traveling between Georgia and Mississippi. The trial started in Hattiesburg, Mississippi on September 30, 1991, 4 years after the Sherry murders, and sliding in right before the statute of limitations would have run out on any conspiracy charges. The headlines screamed, "Sherry murder trial," but in reality, no one was charged with their murders. The first witness up was James Dickey, a man who had come out of the closet 9 years earlier and had reported being scammed, only to be ignored by Louisiana officials, uninterested in pursuing charges for a gullible gay man. But Mr. Dickey was an educated man, an activist, and a journalist. He had even heard of the scams and con games, preying on the elderly and lonely, and yes, homosexual men. He had even written about it. He was the last one to believe he could fall victim to the scam, but he had. And he made an excellent witness, homophobia be damned. Smart and well-spoken, James Dickey came across as an honest, professional man, embarrassed by what had happened to him, but not afraid to testify about it now. One of John Ransom's associates testified that Mike Gillich talked to him and Ransom about a hit. The associate said he was out of town for the murders, but he claimed Ransom later admitted to him that he killed the Sherrys. The courtroom antics in this case are astounding. At one point, a fuse blew, and the electricity went out in the courtroom. When the lights came back on, four bailiffs were standing around Ransom, protecting the judge, jury, and the rest of the courtroom from the legendary hitman. He had made quite the spectacle of himself at trial, and so did Kirksey Nix. Mike Gillich went so far as to flipping the bird at reporters outside the courtroom. Sherry LaRoche Sharp attacked a reporter with her purse one day. You cannot make this shit up. I recommend reading Edwin Hume's book, Mississippi Mud, Southern Justice and the Dixie Mafia, for a full rundown. In fact, there is no way I could have fit even half of this Southern Gothic tale into one episode. I cannot recommend his book enough. The jury was allowed to rule on the conspiracy charge without specifying whether a defendant conspired to murder or defraud or both. But after 6 weeks of trial testimony, everyone but Sherry LaRoche was found guilty of conspiracy murder and wire fraud. Kirksey Nix, Mike Gillich, and John Ransom were all found guilty of murder for hire for traveling between Georgia and Mississippi. Nix was sentenced to 15 years in prison, but of course he was already serving a life sentence. So this was tacked onto his time, ensuring he would probably never get parole. Mr. Mike also got 15 years in prison. When he was eligible for release, he'd have to spend 3 years on probation. John Ransom was sentenced to 10 years. When he was eligible for release, he'd also have to spend 3 years on probation. Sherry LaRoche Sharp was sentenced to 1 year and 1 week in prison for her part in the Lonely Hearts scam and wire fraud. She got a better deal for testifying against Nix and Gillich. When she was eligible for release, she'd have to spend 3 years on probation. Then in 1994, Mr. Mike Gillich finally agreed to talk to the FBI in exchange for a shorter sentence. Gillich told the FBI exactly what Bobby Joe Fabian had said. Pete Hallett told Kirksey Nix that Vincent Sherry stole the money in order to save his own life. He knew he was in the crosshairs, up to his neck in this mess, so he threw his best friend and law partner under the bus. That's when Nix and Gillich ordered a hit on Vincent Sherry. Nix and Gillich said they would split the cost of the hitman. They were going to hire John Ransom, but decided on a man named Thomas Holcomb. They hired Holcomb to kill Vincent for $20,000, around $45,000 today. Later, they said, Pete Hallett did offer to help pay, but Gillich supposedly told him it was taken care of. Margaret Sherry's murder was just a bonus and a precaution. Mike Gillich knew that Pete Hallett wanted to run for mayor, and besides, they didn't need a do-gooder Republican snooping into her husband's murder investigation. It was a win-win for all of these creeps. After all of these years, investigators finally had Pete Hallett. In 1996, the government indicted Nix, Sharp, Hallett, and Holcomb on 52 charges, including racketeering, conspiracy to violate the racket statute, fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy to obstruct justice. Sherry LaRoche Sharp was charged with obstruction of justice and conspiracy to obstruct justice for her false testimony that she gave in the 1991 trial. Pete Hallett was charged with conspiracy to obstruct justice based on false statements he made during the 1991 investigation and trial testimony. He was also charged with obstruction of justice, conspiracy to violate the racketeering statute, racketeering, and conspiracy to commit wire fraud. And Thomas Holcomb, the trigger man, was charged with conspiracy to violate the racketeering statute and conspiracy to obstruct justice, but not for murder. It's interesting that no one was charged with conspiracy to murder in this indictment. People always lump Pete Hallett in as being a co-conspirator in the murders, which he was, and yet he was never even charged with conspiracy murder. During the trial, Mike Gillich testified that Thomas Holcomb put superglue on his fingers so that he wouldn't leave any fingerprints on the gun he used to kill the Sherrys. Gillich said he watched Holcomb put the glue on before he went over to the Sherrys' house. The plan was for him to knock on the Sherry's door and then kill them. Vince Sherry did answer the door, just like the police had suspected. And Holcomb had used the yellow unmarked car that had been stolen and then put in another lot. That was a good lead. Lynn was right. All John Ransom had done was supply the weapon with a silencer. If that fool had turned state's evidence in the first trial, he would have gotten his immunity. He wasn't the trigger man. On July 16th, the jury found Nix, Sharp, and Holcomb guilty of all charges. They found Pete Hallett only guilty of obstruction of justice and conspiracy to obstruct justice. The judge asked the jury to try and deliberate again on the remaining charges against Hallett. On July 17th, the jury found Hallett also guilty of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to violate the racketeering statute. On September 22, 1997, Hallett was sentenced to 216 months for a RICO conspiracy, 120 months for obstruction of justice, 60 months for conspiracy to obstruct justice, and 60 months for conspiracy to commit mail fraud for his part in the Lonely Hearts scam. The sentences were to be served concurrently for a total of 18 years in prison. While sentencing Pete Hallett, the judge said, if Mr. Hallett had been truthful about the missing money in the beginning, the Sherrys would not be dead. Kirksey Nix got another life sentence in prison. He will most certainly die there. Thomas Holcomb also got life in prison. Sherry LaRoche Sharp was sentenced to 5 years. After Pete Hallett was found guilty, Lynn Sherry shook Mr. Mike's hand and thanked him. I want to say thank you. Thank you for telling the truth. You're the only one who would, and I just wanted to say thank you, she said. Sobbing, Mr. Mike just kept saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Mr. Mike, after spending time in prison away from his family, had a total change of heart. After court, he caught up to Lynn and said, I'm so sorry. I only thought of what I was doing for my family. I never thought of what I was doing to anybody else's. I'm so sorry for what I did to your family. Lynn later said he really, honestly, was as repentant as you can get. It wasn't an act. Mike Gillich received an early release because he helped with the investigation, and he was let out in 2000. He died of cancer in April 2012 at the age of 82. Kirksey Nix is currently incarcerated in the El Reno Federal Correctional Institution in El Reno, Oklahoma. He is 77 years old. Thomas Holcomb died in prison on April 8, 2005. He was 52 years old. John Ransom was released on November 7, 2003, whereabouts unknown, but he would be 93 years old. Neither Haley, my research assistant, nor I could find an obituary for Ransom, so he could still be alive. Pete Hallett was released from a Montgomery, Alabama federal prison in March 2012. Then he went to a halfway house in Hattiesburg. He worked as a handyman at St. Thomas Catholic Church on the University of Southern Mississippi campus. 70-year-old Hallett was released from the halfway house in April of 2013. As of 2017, Hallett was living in Ocean Springs with his wife, Sandra. Haley and I could not find an obituary on him either, so we assume he is still alive. He would be 77 years old by now. Ironically, the Sherry murders are technically still open cases. No one was ever charged with their murders. But Mr. Mike, the godfather of Biloxi and leader of the Dixie Mafia, had broken their one code. Thou shalt not snitch to the cops. He had never served time before, and after a few years in prison, old and away from his family, he broke. He finally saw the pain of Lynn Spicito and her family. And she and her family did feel he was truly repentant. They forgave him. I've spoken before about the power of forgiveness. Somehow, Lynn and her family found peace with Mike Gillich's confession. The people that killed their parents were finally punished, and Lynn and her family were finally able to move on with their lives. Lynn and her siblings obviously still miss their parents. Today, she watches her grandchildren and feels an ache that they will never know her mother and father. That's a loss that never goes away, and she still chooses forgiveness. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you so much to Haley Gray for her diligent research assistance in this complicated case. And thank you to author Edward Humes for his amazing book, Mississippi Mud. He opens his book with an explanation of what Mississippi Mud meant. It's a poker game. It's a game where the cards are irrelevant. The point is to bluff and betray fellow players. It's a fantastic metaphor for the Sherry murders. I have a few listeners to thank for suggesting this case. Casey Porter, Eileen Mace, Andrew Stewart. Thanks, guys. You picked a good one. Please remember to practice social distancing. Wash your hands and think of your friends, family, and neighbors. We all need to do our part. Stay home and stay safe. If you need to go out, wear a mask. It's not foolproof, so keep your distance from others, but it's better than nothing. Look on YouTube for videos on how to make masks out of bandanas or leggings. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage 3 platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. So until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.